This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on May 19th, 2025.
Good evening! It's great to be in Manchester and back in the UK. Welcome to the Land of Hope and Dreams tour. The mighty E Street Band is here tonight to call upon the righteous power of art, of music, of rock and roll in dangerous times. In my home, the America I love, the America I've written about, that has been a beacon of hope and liberty for 250 years, is currently in the hands of a corrupt, incompetent, and treasonous administration. Tonight, we ask all who believe in democracy and the best of our American experience to rise with us, raise your voices against authoritarianism, and let freedom ring.
Yeah, let's do it. Always wanted Springsteen to open for me. Now he has.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. On the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Del Marva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. And when I say us, I mean Desi Doyen, who is, as usual, here with us as well. How are you doing, Desiree?
Doing just fine.
Excellent news. Welcome all to the Bradcast. We do have a lot to get to, as usual, including a guest joining me momentarily, formerly of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, here to discuss an important and troubling development, very troubling, at least as far as I see it, regarding the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. As democracy continues to be endangered here in a very real way in the United States, as you heard Bruce Springsteen mention in our opening there, as he kicked off his Land of Hope and Dreams tour in the UK last week, I would like to thank President Donald Trump for bringing that clip to my attention over the weekend, as released by Springsteen on YouTube, and he had still more to say that I'd like to share with you as well today, because I think it sets the scene for today's show, frankly, for the Bradcast in general, damn near every day at this point, and especially where we are right now, where we are headed, unless the people, the voters, decide otherwise, are allowed to decide otherwise in the months and the years ahead.
The last check The last check on power, after the checks and balances of government have failed, are the people. You and me. It's in the union of people around a common set of values. Now that's all that stands between democracy and authoritarianism. So at the end of the day, all we've really got is each other. Now, there's some very weird, strange, and dangerous shit going on out there right now. In America, they are persecuting people for using their right to free speech and voicing their dissent. This is happening now. In America, the richest men are taking satisfaction in abandoning the world's poorest children to sickness and death. This is happening now. In my country, they're taking sadistic pleasure in the pain that they inflict on loyal American workers. They're rolling back historic civil rights legislation that led to a more just and plural society. They're abandoning our great allies and siding with dictators against those struggling for their freedom. They're defunding American universities that won't bow down to their ideological demands. They're removing residents off American streets and without due process of law are deporting them to foreign detention centers and prisons. This is all happening now. A majority of our elected representatives have failed to protect the American people from the abuses of an unfit president and a rogue government. They have no concern or idea of what it means to be deeply American. The America that I've sung to you about for 50 years is real, and regardless of its faults, is a great country with a great people. So we'll survive this moment. Now, I have hope because I believe in the truth of what the great American writer James Baldwin said. He said, in this world, there isn't as much humanity as one would like, but there's enough. Let's pray.
That was Patriot Bruce Springsteen in Manchester, England last week, sounding the alarm. Kicking off his Land of Hope and Dreams tour, again, my thanks to President Donald Trump for bringing that clip to my attention over the weekend via his failing social media site so that I could share it with you all here today. I will link to the YouTube video when I post today's show at bradblog.com in the event that there is anyone you would like to share it back. As to his point about rolling back civil rights legislation, we will be talking about that with my guest momentarily. And of course, speaking of democracy and the fight to maintain it, a fight that we regularly wage on this program for years and years at this point. While Donald Trump's election victory last year has been terrible, obviously, for the U.S. and those of us who oppose authoritarianism and who support democracy and free speech and due process of law and a democratic constitutional republic. Well, his victory here in the U.S., it seems, has been a catalyst against right-wing authoritarianism in one country after another in recent elections. In recent weeks, we have reported on this program on the stunning election victories after reversals of fortune for Labour and Liberal parties in Canada and then in Australia, where in both cases, the centre-left parties had been facing almost certain defeat over the past few months in their elections this year until Trump's rise to power here in the U.S. and his economic and political aggressions against longtime allies around the world. Actions which appear to have quickly reversed the fortunes of centrist and left-leaning parties against the rising tide of global right-wing nationalism. So within just the last month or so, we saw Labour and Liberal parties in Canada and then Australia re-elect a Liberal anti-fascist prime minister while not only defeating right-wing nationalist candidates who oppose them and allied themselves closely with Donald Trump, but in both cases, voters in elections that defied history actually removed the opposing candidates from office completely, from their own local seats of parliament in the very same election, in a wild political pendulum swing from right to left in both of those countries in just a matter of a few short months since Trump's rise to power in the U.S. here made the threat of such leaders clear to voters around the world. And then, over this past weekend, well, it has happened yet again. As the New York Times reports today, in a setback for Europe's surging nationalist forces, Nikusor Dan, a centrist mayor and former mathematics professor, on Sunday won the presidential election in Romania, defeating a hard-right candidate there who was aligned, yes, with Donald Trump and has opposed military aid to neighboring Ukraine. With more than 98% of the ballots counted as of late last night, preliminary official results gave 54% of the vote in the presidential runoff to the 55-year-old Dan, the mayor of Romania's capital, Bucharest, while his opponent, George Simion, a nationalist and fervent admirer of Trump, who had been widely seen as the front runner, well, he drew just 46%. As he slipped behind Dan in early counting, Mr. Simion, and in a move that Americans may recognize, told supporters, quote, "We are the clear winners of these elections." He called for the national protests if the final count should reveal him to be the loser, railing against what he said was an attempt, quote, "to steal the victory of the Romanian people."
Wow. So the same authoritarian playbook.
Same playbook. Same Yikes. Script, man. Same yeah. words. So, yeah, as it turns out, authoritarians really, really do not like democracy, it seems, which is just one of the reasons that I have a problem with authoritarians. They don't like democracy unless it happens to work out well for them. Then they love to pretend they give a damn about it. In the final days of the campaign in Romania, as opinion polls showed the race tightening, Simion laid the groundwork for a Romanian version of Trump's Stop the Steal efforts in 2020. The Times reports he insisted that only electoral fraud could prevent him from winning. Sound familiar? On Sunday, shortly before voting ended, Simion claimed that, quote, "many deceased people had appeared on electoral lists," echoing the claims of Trump after he lost the 2020 election in the U.S. Trump never actually produced any evidence of those tens of thousands of dead people who voted, as he claimed. In fact, the evidence proved just the opposite, even if it didn't stop Trump from repeating the same evidence-free false claims over and over and over in 2020 after he lost. In Simion's case in Romania, he similarly provided zero evidence to support accusations that his victorious rival had somehow benefited from fraud. Dan's victory against the Romanian president candidate, who was a presidential candidate who was supported by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and Vladimir Putin, among others, on the hard nationalist right. Well, that was a big victory for neighboring Ukraine as well over the weekend. According to Kyiv Independent yesterday, President Volodymyr Zelensky congratulated Dan on his victory, quote, "For Ukraine, as a neighbor and friend, it is important to have a reliable partner in Romania. By working together," he said, "we can strengthen both our countries and our shared Europe." The result comes as a relief for Ukraine, who faced the loss of a key ally in the event of a Simeon victory. According to The Independent, who notes that his party, the Alliance for the Union of Romanians, championed a platform that included ending military aid for Ukraine. Quote, "Ukraine needs us. We don't need Ukraine," Simeon said during a televised debate in May. Dan, an independent centrist, supports aid to Ukraine. He called it, quote, "essential for the security of Romania." The current election follows the annulment of the first round of voting back in November of last year, which Romania's constitutional court invalidated due to evidence of foreign influence, foreign interference by outside pro-nationalist organizations and countries, yes, including Russia. That round was won by a populist candidate who openly promoted conspiracy theories and supported Russia, calling Ukraine a fictional state, that's a quote, and predicting its annexation to Russia as, quote, inevitable. He did not run in the second round. Romania has provided Ukraine with crucial defense and humanitarian support throughout Russia's full-scale war. The country donated a U.S.-made Patriot missile system back in 2024 and signed a bilateral security agreement with Kyiv. Bucharest has also played a crucial role in the transit of Ukrainian agricultural exports amid Russia's threats to Ukraine's critical Black Sea maritime trade. So, another victory, as I see it, for democracy itself and against the rising tide of nationalism and authoritarianism in yet another country where a rising tide of fascism and pro-Trump candidates had seemed inevitable just months ago, in some cases just weeks ago, until voters decided otherwise after seeing how it has all worked out for us here. Worked out so far for their friends back here in the U.S. with the election of our own authoritarian wannabe dictatorial leader. Yeah, that kind of splashes some cold water on your face, it seems to me. Of course, Trump supporters in this country, well, they are taking notice of all of this. But even before Trump's rise to power, the Republican Party has long had it out for democracy. Democracy and the right to vote, long before Donald Trump stepped into this mess. Toward that end, those who oppose democracy, they had another court victory last week, a troubling one that is further endangering and handicapping whatever is left at this point of our landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. We'll be joined momentarily by a former DOJ official who served in the civil rights section under Barack Obama to help us make sense of both the court ruling last week that will make it much harder for plaintiffs to file voting rights complaints, voting rights lawsuits, and for some insights, if we have time, on how the civil rights and voting rights section at the Department of Justice, once the crowning jewel of the agency, how those sections are now being gutted by the Trump administration. As usual, there's been a lot of other news since we last spoke on this program late last week. The financial firm Moody's has now dropped the United States AAA bond rating for the first time, citing, among other issues, the Republicans and Trump's so-called big, beautiful budget bill that will increase the national debt by trillions of dollars in order to help fund Donald Trump's huge tax cuts, mostly for millionaires, billionaires, and corporations, even while that same bill will cut health care funding for millions of Americans. The bill would do that, Trump's so-called one big beautiful bill, encompasses the bulk of his entire legislative agenda. It was rejected by Republican deficit hawks in a key budget committee in the U.S. House on Friday because it didn't cut enough health care from the neediest Americans, apparently. Though late on Sunday night, the committee met again. I think they were called to meet at 10 p.m. on Sunday night, this time voting again and passing the measure, allowing it to move forward this week to the House floor for a vote, where House Speaker Mike Johnson hopes to adopt the measure with a simple majority vote before the Memorial Day break at the end of this week. He can afford to lose just 3 Republican votes before this thing does not pass, presuming all Democrats vote against it, given the GOP's slim majority in the lower chamber. If successful, this really cruel bill, which undermines health care and nutrition support for millions of Americans, including millions of children and disabled people, all in order to fund the tax cuts to the wealthy and expand deficit spending, which you'll recall Republicans used to pretend to oppose, but only when they're in power, when they're not in power, I should say. If this is passed this week, it would move the bill to the U.S. Senate, where it would also require only a simple majority. There ain't no filibuster that's going to save things over in the Senate, given that they have structured this as a so-called reconciliation bill, which means it would be allowed to bypass the Senate's normal filibuster rules, which require 60 votes for passage. In this case, all it requires is a bare one-vote majority. It doesn't even require that, actually. A 50-50 vote would pass the bill, because Vice President J.D. Vance is the president of the U.S. Senate, to pass the deciding vote in the event of a tie.
So basically what we're seeing here has been Republicans arguing over how many American children should go hungry,
yep,
and how many poor Americans should go without access to health care,
yep,
so that billionaires can get yet another tax.
Correct.
Debt.
And the argument is not how many should it be, less or more. The argument is it must be more. They want more people to be cut off of Medicaid.
Not enough people are going hungry. Not enough people are
benefits.
Losing it.
Gotcha. Correct, yeah. So that's where we are there. We'll see what unfolds in the days ahead, and then as it moves over to the Senate and so forth. Also over the weekend, Joe Biden's family announced that the 82-year-old former president has an aggressive form of prostate cancer that has now spread to his bones. Though his doctors suggest his particular type of cancer may be treatable with hormone therapy. We hope that's the case. More on all of that and much more, no doubt, on all of this and other things as this week progresses here on the broadcast. But before I get to my guest today, one more story that I want to note. It's a bit of hopeful news from the otherwise corrupted far-right U.S. Supreme Court that came out late on Friday. As Politico described it, President Donald Trump's drive to use an 18th century law to rapidly expel alleged Venezuelan gang members suffered yet another legal setback on Friday as the Supreme Court extended its block on deporting dozens of men currently held in immigration detention in northern Texas. The court emphasized that the men, whom the Trump administration has labeled alien enemies, are actually entitled to more due process than the administration has so far provided to them before deportation under Trump's legally dubious, and I'm being nice here, calling it legally dubious, his invocation of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which allows detention and deportation of migrants with little or no due process, but only if they're migrants from a nation that has declared war on the U.S. I don't think Venezuela has done that. Or in the event of an invasion, quote, invasion or predatory incursion, one that is at the direction of the government of another country. In this case, that would be Venezuela. And in fact, U.S. National Intelligence Community has, in fact, found that, nope, there is no evidence that Venezuela is directing members of a Venezuelan gang to invade or predatorily incur on the U.S. In an unsigned opinion posted late on Friday, the High Court, in a 7-2 ruling with Justices, guess, Alito and Thomas, as usual, dissenting, the justices posted their opinion, finding fault with the administration for its attempt last month to carry out swift deportations just one day after providing a bare-bones deportation notice to the detainees, with little or no opportunity for these migrants, alleged to be Venezuelan gang members, to challenge their removal in a court of law. The Supreme Court intervened at that time to stop those deportations, and in Friday's decision, the court elaborated on its decision and extended its order blocking the deportations. Quote, notice roughly 24 hours before removal, devoid of information about how to exercise due process rights to contest that removal, surely does not pass muster, the court's opinion said, without deciding exactly how much notice would be required. Shortly after the ruling, Trump repeatedly blasted the court on social media, calling the ruling, quote, saying that the Supreme Court has just, quote, ruled that the worst murderers, drug dealers, gang members, and even those who are mentally insane who came into our country illegally are not allowed to be forced out without going through a long, protracted, and expensive legal process. Of course, as we and the High Court have already seen, many of those already deported under the administration's misuse of the Alien Enemies Act had been charged with no crimes at all. Many appear to be here perfectly lawfully. And despite Trump's false claims and obviously photoshopped evidence to the contrary, they do not appear, even to be some of them, to even be gang members at all, dangerous or otherwise. As our friend, legal journalist Mark Joseph Stern of Slate pointed out on Friday, quote, the Supreme Court does not decide whether the Trump administration can remove migrants under the Alien Enemies Act, but holds that its efforts to do so violate due process. It instructs the lower courts to decide exactly what deportation procedures would comply with the U.S. Constitution, so we can look forward to that. This is especially critical, Stern notes, because as SCOTUS points out, the Trump administration claims it cannot retrieve migrants once they have been sent to CECOT. That's the maximum security gulag in El Salvador. With the court observing correctly, if that is true, well, then migrants must receive especially robust due process protections because they may be expelled to El Salvador and have no way to get back, even if they were incorrectly expelled. So here, I think the Trump administration hoisted on its own petard in that regard. Now, if as you claim, you know, you can't get them back once they're sent away, well, we better make sure that each and every one of them gets to make their proper challenges to their deportation in a court of law before they're sent away for a potential life sentence. In a maximum security prison where people have been tortured without any ability to challenge any of this, in a country that many of these people are not even from. You'll notice Venezuela turns out to be an entirely different nation from El Salvador. Meanwhile, at the same time that the Supreme Court is upholding due process rights for migrants, lower appeals courts, at least one of them here in the U.S., is taking away the right for American citizens to sue their government, to protect their own voting rights under the law and Constitution. In a disturbing new ruling last week from the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. That story with my guest Justin Levitt, formerly of the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division, is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Right, right, you're bloody well right. You got a bloody right to say. Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
Yeah, but we will see. We will see how many rights you have as they take away one by one by one, or at least as they try to. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com.
Can you take that down, Wendell, a little bit? Thank you, sir.
In a ruling that received not nearly enough notice last week, amid everything else, a panel of the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has struck down one of the last key remaining ways of enforcing the Federal Voting Rights Act in 7 mainly Midwestern states. For decades, private individuals and voting rights organizations have brought the majority of lawsuits for enforcing the landmark law's Section 2 protections against racial discrimination in the election process. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act became even more vital than ever in recent years after the U.S. Supreme Court effectively gutted the landmark Section 5 protections of the Act, which had required jurisdictions with a history of racial disenfranchisement at the ballot box to demonstrate in advance that any new voting rules that they adopted would not be racially discriminatory. Without the use of Section 5, many voters were forced to use Section 2 to challenge laws said to be discriminatory. And for decades, they've been able to file suit to block such discriminatory laws and rules. But back in 2023, in the same 8th Circuit, a different panel of judges found that the Voting Rights Act was not privately enforceable, that private individuals or groups could not sue to challenge a violation of the Voting Rights Act, that only the Department of Justice could do so, at least in the states covered by the 8th Circuit's ruling. That would include Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. This was stunning news at the time that we covered on this show as it broke, given that, as The Guardian explained, since 1982, there have been 466 Section 2 cases brought. Only 18 of them were brought by the Department of Justice. The rest were all brought by private individuals, private voters, voting rights organizations, and so forth. So if this decision from the 8th Circuit holds up that private groups, private voters cannot sue under the Voting Rights Act, well, it would mean that if only the DOJ can bring such lawsuits, that when there's a Republican in the White House, there may be zero challenges at all, even to the most wildly discriminatory new voting laws. In 2023, after the ruling of the 8th Circuit, the plaintiffs in that case faced a very difficult decision. Should they challenge the ruling up to the Supreme Court, where Chief Justice John Roberts and his Republican majority have been sort of chipping away at the voting rights law for years, risking that the 8th Circuit's ruling, which then only applied to voters in those 7 states, that it would then be applied to the entire country? Or should they bide their time and use a separate means for challenging violations of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 1983 of an entirely separate law that allows private individuals to bring suit against violations of civil rights? They decided, as I understand it, to do the latter. But last week, in a 2-1 ruling, another 3-judge panel in the 8th Circuit found that Section 2 cannot be enforced by lawsuits from private parties under Section 1983 either. So now what? Well, joining us now to explain these apparent nightmares for democracy and what is left of the Voting Rights Act is someone who understands all of this disturbing news, and I think it is very disturbing, understands it very well. Justin Levitt is a professor of constitutional law at Loyola University Law School here in Los Angeles. He previously served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice under President Obama, where he primarily supported the division's work on voting rights and protections against employment discrimination. Justin then later became the White House's first senior policy advisor for democracy and voting rights under President O'Biden. Under President Biden. And Justin Levitt joins us now. Oh, Professor Levitt, it has been too long, but welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Has indeed. Thanks very much, Brad. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Great to have you. All right. First, I've characterized sort of the basic details of this matter, hopefully correctly. I know we had some trouble getting you online, so I don't know if you heard my my coverage there.
I did indeed.
Okay. So legally speaking, did I get it, the basics of it correct?
Yeah. Legally speaking, you got it spot on.
Okay.
And it is truly unprecedented what the Eighth Circuit has done here. They have effectively eliminated the ability to enforce the Voting Rights Act in the seven states that you mentioned. And that's a very big deal for Iowa, for Arkansas, for North Dakota and South Dakota, for Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And their plaintiffs are going to face a really tough question about whether to appeal this ruling further. The Eighth Circuit was way out of line, but it's not a sure bet that the Supreme Court won't follow them out of that line.
And we'll get to that point in a minute. I just want to, for the moment, I want to make sure that this ruling, those states you just mentioned, it only applies to those seven states comprising the Eighth Circuit, correct?
Correct.
So while voting rights advocates decided to not challenge the ruling initially back in 2023 against the private right to sue, how is this challenge under Section 1983 of the, I think it's of the Civil Rights Act, but it's also blocked now to use that by the Eighth Circuit. How is that a different challenge than the one that we saw under Section 2 in 2023, or are they using the same essential notion to block both of these routes for private challenge to the law?
It's a great question, and it needs getting into the weeds a little bit of how these lawsuits work. When in 2023, the plaintiffs got this bad news,
mm-hmm.
the Eighth Circuit issued its first dead wrong opinion. That affected whether people could sue directly under the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the plaintiffs' decision not to appeal that was made a little bit easier by the fact that there was a second door that they could go through to get to the same place.
Mm-hmm.
So even if people couldn't sue directly under the Voting Rights Act, there's an incredibly powerful civil rights statute, maybe the most powerful civil rights statute there is, that says when a state or local government deprives you of your rights under the Constitution
mm-hmm.
or under federal law, you get to sue them mm-hmm. to get relief.
Mm-hmm.
That's this Section 1983 thing, you absolutely correctly said. It's the basis for the vast majority of civil rights suits across the country. And that was the door that was still available in 2023. So even though the Eighth Circuit's decision in 2023 was dead wrong,
mm-hmm.
it didn't matter quite so much because plaintiffs who were blocked from going in the front door could just go in the side door.
Right.
And it got to the same place. Now, the latest decision a week ago shuts all the doors. And this is a much more serious business for anybody sitting in those seven states and looking at discriminatory laws
mm-hmm.
that affect election rights and wondering whether they're ever going to get redress.
The Eighth Circuit is here, seems to be saying that because the Voting Rights Act, which has been updated and reauthorized, reconfirmed by overwhelming bipartisan majorities in Congress several times over the years since its original passage, since the text does not explicitly say that there is a right, a private right to sue to enforce the law, that suddenly the Eighth Circuit here is saying that, well, after, I mean, there's been, you know, more than 400 private challenges, I mentioned, that have already been heard by the court to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that all of a sudden there can be no more private challenges because it's not written in there specifically. But, Justin, how can that be? Did hundreds of courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, simply miss the fact that there was no such right written into it over all of these decades when, you know, when determining, as they always do, that plaintiffs have the proper standing to sue? How can it be that all of a sudden the Eighth District discovered this and nobody else has noticed?
Hang on just a moment. I believe we may have lost him, so
oh,
I'm
no.
going to try to call him again.
Oh, no.
So I guess hold that thought.
And it was such a good, try to get him. It was such a good question, too.
I know. So just a moment, please.
Yeah. You get him. Let me know when you're there, when he's there.
Okay.
Because it's mind-blowing to me that, you know, this is not a case where they suddenly somebody challenged a specific point that hasn't come up before. This is an issue that every time there is a challenge to the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, every single time, in any case, whether it's a challenge to the VRA or anything else, every single time they have to make sure that whoever is suing has standing to do so. And one of the things they look at is, well, are they allowed to sue under this law? And every time, in hundreds and hundreds of cases, they have determined that, yes, these private individuals or these voting rights groups and so forth do, in fact, have the standing to sue. But now, all of a sudden, the Eighth Circuit Court says, nope, they don't. Do we got Justin back?
Yes.
Justin, I don't know if you heard.
Yes, you do.
Sorry about the tech problems. I don't know if you heard any part of my question there. It was basically, how can it be that we've had more than 400 cases, challenges under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and now under 1983, and they still, none of the courts noticed, other than the Eighth Circuit, that somehow this is unlawful.
Yeah, so it can't be. You're right in the premise of the question. You know, sometimes, every once in a while, mm-hmm. if you're the first judge in 60 years mm-hmm. to read a particular statute a particular way, it means you're the one genius.
Right.
But most of the time, if you're the first judge in 60 years to read a statute a particular way, that means you got it wrong.
Uh-huh.
And this one's the latter.
Okay.
As you say, there have been 400 cases in which private plaintiffs have brought voting rights suits under the Voting Rights Act. And in all that time, no other court, no committee in Congress, no president has ever thought
uh-huh.
that the Voting Rights Act forbids that, including plenty of cases by the Supreme Court,
right,
which never mentioned the notion that maybe private plaintiffs shouldn't be sitting in front of them in the first place. So this is brand new and out of nowhere, and in so many ways, dead wrong. This is about people in robes forgetting why they're there. Actually, people in love with the particular statutory interpretation methodology and forgetting that what they're supposed to be doing is effectuating the intent of Congress.
Right.
And if you think about it for 30 seconds, Congress back in 1965, Congress in 1982, when it seriously amended the Voting Rights Act, absolutely thought that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund would be bringing cases right alongside the Department of Justice and others. And it's ludicrous to think that Congress wanted anything different than that.
They obviously thought that because up till then, we had already had many such cases that yep. had been filed. So they would have had the chance to change it then when they reauthorized it for another, 25 years after during George W. Bush administration?
Yeah, repeatedly.
Yeah.
I mean, they re-upped the Voting Rights Act in 1970. They re-upped it in 75. They re-upped it in 82. They mm-hmm. re-upped it in 2006. And at no point in that process did they say, hey, we notice an awful lot of private plaintiffs seem to be bringing suits. We got to shut that down.
Right.
In part because they didn't want to shut it down.
Right. Of course. And this, you know, I have to underscore, this, you know, largely since Justice Antonin Scalia's his campaign, I think, for so-called textualism and originalism, meaning, you know, what does the actual text of the law or the constitutional statute say? What was the original intent of the framers of the particular statute? Well, we know all of these things, and it just seems to be ignored in this decision by the Eighth Circuit, this three-judge panel. Justin Levitt, I didn't look at the political makeup of this. We've seen a number of cases like this where you've got, for example, two Trump appointees. Do you know the makeup of that three-judge panel on the Eighth Circuit who made this particular decision?
Yeah, I did look,
yeah,
unfortunately.
Okay.
And this particular makeup did have a W appointee and a Trump appointee in the majority.
Mm-hmm.
I got to point out that that's not particularly indicative. Mm-hmm. There have been plenty of W appointees and Trump appointees and other appointees appointed by Republican presidents,
mm-hmm,
who have sensibly construed statutes before. And the exceedingly strong dissent, the dissent that points out we've had 400 private election suits over this and none of them thought that this is the way you read the statute,
mm-hmm,
was also a W appointee. So it's not necessarily the party of the appointing president that, mm-hmm, determines whether you're an idiot when you're on the bench or not.
Right.
It happens that two judges just got this one dead wrong. And I'll say on textualism, you're right that Justice Scalia and some of his justices who follow in his mold on, mm-hmm, the Supreme Court now,
mm-hmm,
are the preeminent defenders of this way to read statutes,
mm-hmm,
but even they recognize that the job of the courts is to try and figure out what Congress would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
What they say is that the best evidence of what Congress would have wanted is the text of the statute itself.
Mm-hmm.
But even they recognize that sometimes the text doesn't actually tell you, isn't actually the best guide to what Congress would have wanted the statute to do. And if you step back and think for 30 seconds about whether Congress wanted the Voting Rights Act to be enforced by private plaintiffs, the answer is a clear and unambiguous and obvious yes. And I think that even Justice Scalia, even on the court now, Justice Gorsuch, who, mm-hmm, pretends to favor textualism, except, yeah, when he doesn't,
right?
I think that they would conclude the same thing. This is not a hard case.
You would think it is not hard, but I think, as I understand it, I think as Thomas and Gorsuch have both indicated that they are interested in adjudicating this matter, and I don't think they're interested in adjudicating it to put it to bed to what it obviously means to you and me and, you know, more than 400 private individuals who have brought suit. But, you know, and again, I just want to underscore the point. The last time that this was, that the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized, it was under George W. Bush, and it was almost unanimous in both,
correct,
houses, and to George W. Bush's credit. So I'm not saying that, you know, this is Republicans bad here. What I am saying is that this seems to be so clearly out of line from what the people who adopted this law had intended. It comes
and
out
from every, yeah, other judge in the country.
Okay.
I mean, that's absolutely right. But it's important to recognize that these are extreme outliers.
Well, if they're so extreme, then there should be no harm in challenging it on up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Right, Justin?
So I think what you'll see first,
yeah,
is a challenge to the whole of the Eighth Circuit, a procedure called sitting on bonk,
mm-hmm,
where every single judge, you know, normally in the appellate process, you get three judges reviewing a single trial court.
Right.
And there is a process for saying, look, three judges can make a mistake. Let's get everybody who sits on the circuit together.
Right.
I strongly suspect you'll see the plaintiffs ask for en banc review, ask for the entire Eighth Circuit to reconsider this decision. There's no downside to doing that.
Right.
If that doesn't end up reversing this panel,
because it didn't reverse it in 2023, as I understand it, I think they did ask for an en banc hearing.
They did.
And in fact, the majority of the Eighth Circuit actually agreed with that terrible ruling back in 23, right?
Correct. That was still shutting the front door, but leaving the side door open.
Okay.
And I got to wonder if the answer is shutting all the doors, whether they might reconsider, or at least a few judges might reconsider, which might be enough. If that doesn't happen, and it is, yes, unfortunately, conceivable that that doesn't happen, there's going to have to be a really hard choice. I don't think that this case is difficult at all. Mm-hmm. And even if Justice Thomas doesn't agree with me, mm-hmm. I don't think this should be difficult for a majority of the Supreme Court. But there have been Supreme Court cases recently that I have also thought shouldn't be difficult, that the court has thought more difficult than expected.
Yeah.
So if you're living in the year 2025
yep.
and you're paying attention, I can't tell you that the Supreme Court is going to do the right thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say I am living in 2025, so I share your concerns about that. So, Justin, with Section 5 now largely sidelined entirely, if Section 2 were to become largely unenforceable, at least under a Republican administration, which does not tend to bring Section 2 cases, is there anything left at that point of the landmark Voting Rights Act that could be used to protect voting rights as we head into an election year next year?
Not much that's going to be a consolation. So I will say that the Supreme Court made it extremely difficult to win Section 2 cases, mm-hmm. cases that depend not on a showing of discriminatory intent, but on a disparate impact that's connected to discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
They made it extremely difficult to win those cases in the context of election procedures, mm-hmm. how we cast and count ballots, after a case out of Arizona a couple years ago. And so it is, even without this Eighth Circuit nonsense,
mm-hmm. yeah.
still really, really hard to win cases under the Voting Rights Act that have to do with how we cast and count ballots. It's more meaningful in redistricting cases.
Uh-huh.
And these cases, the first one in 2023 you mentioned out of Arkansas was a redistricting case.
Right.
This one just last week out of North Dakota was a redistricting case. Mm-hmm. Those cases aren't really dependent election cycle to election cycle, but there's still real meat
yep.
in Section 2 there. The Supreme Court said, really notable opinion out of Alabama 2 years ago, there's still a lot of meat in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act for redistricting. And so I think this ends up, as a practical matter, affecting district lines more than it does how we cast and count ballots, which is a real long-term problem.
Right. Oh, yeah.
It's just less relevant for 2026 in particular.
Except to say, if word gets out that there ain't no way to challenge these terrible rules, these discriminatory rules, there is no telling what some of these states would then feel free to do, knowing that there's no real way to challenge what they do other than having the DOJ come after them. And as long as the DOJ is now being run by the civil rights unit is now being run by an activist, a Republican activist who was part of the Stop the Steal suit nonsense. There's going to be no challenges, it seems to me, coming from the Department of Justice if, in fact, the state does decide to pass something that's wildly objectionable and that would normally be shut down under the Voting Rights Act.
So I think, sadly, your forecast of what's coming out of DOJ is likely to be accurate, and the personnel actions that they've taken recently support that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that there are still mechanisms to fight back.
Okay.
So the Voting Rights Act is not the only statute out there. There are other federal statutes that still have private causes of action that private plaintiffs can still bring cases under that help deter or protect against some really bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
There's still also cases directly under the Constitution. Constitution says you can't intentionally discriminate against voters based on their race.
Mm.
And I'm very proud to say that in a difficult case out of North Carolina in 2016, North Carolina was bold enough and stupid enough to target people based on their race
yep.
in a case about election procedures
mm-hmm.
that we won based on their intent
mm-hmm.
rather than based on the effect. And those lawsuits are still available to private plaintiffs even after the Eighth Circuit nonsense, even in North Dakota, even in Arkansas, for legislatures or executives who get particularly bold in the way in which they're inclined to discriminate. So I don't want to count the voters out yet.
Okay.
But you are absolutely right that this opinion out of the Eighth Circuit makes things much more difficult. And that's part of why I'm sure plaintiffs will be looking to reconsider and why they might well head up to the Supreme Court on this one. It's that important.
I concur. Justin, did you guys, I know you were at the White House under Biden, and I can't recall if the timelines matched up here perfectly, but did the White House fight hard enough for that that voting rights legislation that was being held up in the Senate when the Democrats controlled the Senate, but didn't have enough to overcome a filibuster unless they ended the filibuster for Voting Rights Act, which Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were stopping. Did they? Did the White House push hard enough at that time when there was time to fix this?
Yeah, you're asking the right question. I will absolutely go to the mat for the amount of fight that was there. Most of it was not in public because the public fight wouldn't necessarily have helped.
Uh-huh.
But you're right that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were the two votes and the only two votes that stopped that immensely necessary refurbishing of the Voting Rights Act. And any effort by the White House had to consider the fact that you got to convince Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. That's just facts.
It is indeed. All right, we got to get out. Sorry for the technical issues that pushed us a little bit behind. I wanted to talk to you more about what's going on at the Civil Rights Division at the DOJ, because I'm sure you've got some insight for us. That will have to wait.
I got some thoughts. It's true.
I bet you do. That's going to have to wait till another show. Justin Levitt, thanks for joining us. Sorry about all the complications here. Justin Levitt is the professor of constitutional law at Loyola University Law School. Formerly Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice under President Obama, later the Senior Policy Advisor for Democracy and Voting Rights under President Biden. You can find him on the blue skies at Justin Levitt. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Drop me an email at bradcast@bradblog.com and find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, without all the technical problems. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.